Exactamente. Y
No, no como para que
en nuestro caso
no creo
intenta.
que.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Beth R.
This is Donna of Donna and Honey's
WGXC's sustaining supporters
Motel,
are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative
Acre,
community radio,
Hudson,
and
Catskill,
their investment helps to sustain WGXC
FM.
As a public platform.
Tune in
for
WGXC's new Sunday morning schedule with Reverend Kim Singletary, and there's a
you
bright
too
side
can become
somewhere.
A sustaining
every
supporter
Sunday morning at 8
going
a.m.
to WGXC.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Bound by
farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of the New York State Legislature,
Clubhouse Radio,
the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Green County Legislature through the County Initiative Program, administered in Green County by CREATE, the Alexandra and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the T. Backer Fund,
the
Joseph Family Charitable Trust,
Hudson,
and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXC's
single, married,
sustaining supporters,
gay,
who provide
wealthy,
critical
poor,
monthly support
or
to
no
Wave Farms radio
glaze
station,
if you are
WGXC,
just browsing,
90.7
just woke up,
FM.
Or just got out of
thank
jail,
you.
It doesn't
here
matter.
Here are
if
the
you work
WGXC
on Wall Street
headlines.
Or if you sleep on Wall Street,
the United States
belong.
Shot down a Chinese spy
moms,
balloon that had floated from the western United States to off the coast of South Carolina on Saturday, February 4th. Secretary of State Antony Blinken had canceled a previously scheduled trip next week in China because of the incident. President Joe Biden gives the annual State of the Union address at 9 p.m. Tuesday, February 7th. The Bank of Greene County has a plan to grow $5 billion in assets without acquisitions. The bank has already doubled in size in the last 5 years and reached a milestone 2 years ago when it surpassed $2 billion in assets. New York deer are now being infected with the Omicron variant of COVID-19, a study has found. The coronavirus has now been found in deer in 15 states. It was cold on Friday and Saturday in the Hudson Valley and nearby, but a new record for the coldest wind chill ever recorded was minus 108 degrees Fahrenheit, set at the summit of Mount Washington in New Hampshire on February 3rd. That location is at 6,288 feet. Temperature there got down to minus 47 degrees in the early hours of February 4th, which tied the previous record from 1934.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. The Times Union reports on what was the budget proposal Governor Kathy Hochul announced on February 1st. The governor said there would be no new taxes.
A majority of economists are predicting a recession. But the good news is we're prepared. It's also one of the reasons we will not be raising income taxes after we just expedited middle-class tax cuts a year ago. Because it's not a newsflash that New Yorkers already believe they pay too much. Once again, we're submitting a balanced budget for fiscal year 2024.
The Times Union reports some specifics from the budget, including a decrease in higher education spending from $8.1 billion last year to $7.5 billion this year, with tuition increases at SUNY and CUNY schools. But K-12 school aid would increase by $3.1 billion, a 10% increase. Every school district would get at least a 3% increase in financial aid. Hochul's budget proposal also ties the state's minimum wage, currently $14.20 an hour upstate, to inflation. Her budget proposal would also give judges more discretion to set bail by removing a, and I quote, least restrictive, end quote, standard they must apply for certain offenses. Read the full story in the Times Union. Mid-Hudson News reports that Congressperson Pat Ryan went on the floor of the House of Representatives on February 1st to call for the CEO of Central Hudson to resign.
I rise today to bring voice to my constituents who've been screwed over
and ripped off by our utility company, Central Hudson. Mr. Speaker, I rise today for the farmer in Ulster Park, New York, who received such a massive utility bill, $16,585, 17 times her normal bill, that she actually contemplated suicide. Today, I'm calling on Central Hudson CEO, Mr. Charles Frenney, to do the right thing for our community and to resign. We need a new leader who will come in, who will improve service, will finally fix these systemic problems, and start the critical work to rebuild trust with our community. That is what the people of the Hudson Valley deserve.
Ryan also listed several other specific examples of people facing giant irregular bills from Central Hudson. The company is currently under investigation for its billing practices. Central Hudson spokesperson Joe Jenkins wrote in response to Ryan's remarks, saying the utility, and I quote, continues to apologize for the unfortunate impacts that implementation of the new system has had on our customers and key stakeholders. Our number one priority has been and remains resolution of issues with the system, and we continue to make progress. We continue to make enhancements to resolve any remaining issues, end quote. Jenkins also said Central Hudson wants to meet with Ryan and I quote, is working to ensure that customers who received bills requiring an adjustment have been made whole. We are 100% committed to rebuilding relationships with Congressman Ryan and all our stakeholders and to resolving any remaining issues with the system expeditiously, end quote. Read more about this story at Mid-Hudson News. Paul Kirby reports in the Daily Freeman that State Senator Michelle Hinchey's bill that would require utilities to end estimated billing practices has made its way to the Senate floor. Central Hudson has been using estimated bill practices recently and has received thousands of complaints and investigations because of their billing problems. The bill got out of the Energy and Telecommunications Committee on January 31st. Hinchey says the legislation is the only way to guarantee the end of estimated bill practice done by utilities, including Central Hudson Gas and Electric Corp. She said, and I quote, my goal coming into this session is to get my legislation to ban estimated billing passed early, and with its advancement from the Senate Energy and Telecommunications Committee this week, we're on track to do just that. I'm proud that we've built strong momentum in support of my bill, including from the PSC, Public Service Commission, which has officially adopted my bill as part of their recommendations to Central Hudson in light of their investigation. At the end of the day, ending predatory billing practices by utility companies and putting more money back into the pockets of New Yorkers is an issue we can all agree on, end quote. Hinchey represents the 41st Senate District, representing Greene and Columbia counties and Northern Dutchess and Ulster counties. Central Hudson has previously warned that could cause increased rates for consumers, saying that, and I quote, a transition to monthly meter reading for all customers will require revisions to Central Hudson's tariff. Subsequent to commission action, the company will file tariff amendments in compliance with the outcomes of an order in this proceeding, end quote. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
The Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. What's causing the skyrocketing price of eggs? Avian flu, inflation, or supply chain problems typically get the blame. But not so fast, says a nonprofit advocacy group, Farm Action. Diving into Department of Agriculture data, they found no significant drop in supply. Here's Farm Action's Dee Laninga.
We saw nothing that justified these price hikes. They are up 138% since last year. That's more than double. Meanwhile, companies that haven't reported a single case of avian flu are raking in record profits.
Cal-Maine Foods dominates the U.S. egg supply, and their profits increased tenfold last year. Watchdogs say lack of competition is the real culprit. FarmAction's Sarah Carden argues a truly competitive market would have multiple firms challenging each other on price points.
But instead, what we see is all of them raising their prices, which just leads to this conclusion of collusion.
FarmAction has asked the Federal Trade Commission to investigate. Maternal mortality is more than two-thirds higher in rural than urban America, according to the CDC, made worse by the closure of birthing facilities in over 100 rural hospitals just since 2010. Xander Brown looks at the situation in North Carolina.
Pregnancy can be life-changing or life-ending, depending on where you live. Over 20% of counties in North Carolina are classified as maternal care deserts by the March of Dimes, meaning would-be parents have no access to birth centers, OBGYNs, or certified nurse midwives. And the Tar Heel State's maternal mortality is 16% higher than the national rate.
We're working on trying to increase the number of access points for prenatal care and to kind of bolster the social determinants of health that'll help people get that care.
Dr. Suzanne Dixon, OBGYN with Mountain Area Health Education Center, spoke with Carolina Public Press. She says maternal health crisis creates a gap in prenatal as well as postpartum care, access to contraception, and other preventative care.
If you talk to providers of maternal care all over the country, we are seeing an increase in outcomes that are less desirable, like higher rates of hemorrhage and hypertensive crises.
I'm Xander Brown.
Nine tribal schools will get funding to reimagine and transform their outdoor spaces into community gathering areas. Danielle Denk with the Trust for Public Land says a partnership with the Interior Department's Bureau of Indian Education is supporting the effort.
We're really excited to work with local artists so that the outdoors can become a canvas in a way that also delivers recreation.
Denk envisions playgrounds under shady tree canopies becoming civic destinations that draw people to celebrate nature, culture, and community. For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC renewable weather forecast for Monday, February 6th. And we start off each renewable weather forecast with the price of fossil fuels in Greene County. It's $3.54 a gallon at the Stewart's Shops in Caro, lowest price according to the Gas Buddy website. The air quality forecast is a 29. The UV index for Monday is forecast to be a 2, which is on the low range but high for the winter. The water temperature in the Hudson River in Albany is just below 37 degrees, and that is about a degree warmer than it has averaged over the past 10 years on February 5th, where it's been just above 36 degrees then. National Weather Service in Albany predicts Monday should be partly sunny with a high of 38 and a northwest wind 8 to 14 miles per hour spinning local windmills. Monday night, the forecast is for partly cloudy skies with a low around 17 and a north wind 6 to 11 miles per hour. Tuesday, there's a 20% chance of showers after 4 p.m. with increasing clouds during the day and a high of 38. A wind from the south 11 to 16 miles per hour in the morning, and gusts could get as high as 26 miles per hour. Tuesday night, the forecast low is around 34 with a south wind 8 to 17 miles per hour. And then Wednesday, the forecast is for sunny skies with a high of 42 and a low around 26. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, solar-powered radio for open ears.
In the WGXC community calendar, there's all kinds of local community events and concerts like American singer-songwriter Angel Olsen and Nashville indie folk singer-songwriter Aaron Ray perform. February 8th at the Bearsville Center in Woodstock. Find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org and add your event there in the community calendar.
The Catskill Public Library staff loves having the WGXC programmers broadcasting during the week from our Carnegie Room. For information about using the space for a meeting of your own, please call the library at 518-943-4230.
Why did you say that? Aloha out there in Radio Land.
Hey, this is Andy, host of Crawl Out from the Fallout with Raven Sings the Blues. The show is a monthly roundup of new music, plumbing psych, folk, Cosmic Americana, Indie, Garage, and Exploratory titles alongside enough classic gems to hold it all together like glue. You can tune into the show every second Tuesday of the month from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on WGXC 90.7 FM.
We're joined by Liz Moran, who is the New York policy advocate for Earth Justice. And I saw Liz recently leading a rally on the $1 million staircase at the state capitol as part of the campaign for Oil Electric Buildings Act. Liz, what was your feeling response to the rally?
It was such a phenomenal day, an excellent event. You really saw the energy that New Yorkers are bringing to the table here when it comes to electrifying buildings. And that really tracks. There was polling that was actually conducted this past fall about how New Yorkers feel towards all electric new construction. And 66% of New Yorkers support this policy. And so you can really feel that energy there. People are really excited to get New York off of fossil fuels, to make their homes safer, and to save on energy costs, which is another important benefit of moving towards all electric new construction. So it was a very, for lack of a better word, energetic day. And we're feeling strongly encouraged about this budget season.
Now, the governor did actually have something similar to this last year, not quite the timeline. So what does she put in the budget this year, and how does that compare to, you know, the Oil Electric Buildings Act?
Yeah, so last year the governor did have a very small provision dedicated towards all electric new construction that would have mandated it starting in 2027. We're really glad that the governor has put this on the table 2 years running, because it means a conversation is going to be had. There's going to be negotiations during the budget process. So our interest here is very good and should be commended. Regarding the details, there's room for improvement. So the governor's proposal has a start date for all electric new construction for buildings three stories and under starting 2026. And for larger buildings and commercial buildings starting in 2028. So that timeline is pretty weak. We think it's critical to move at a faster pace and entirely doable. New York City has a law on the books where they're going to be starting all electric new construction soon. And starting it for larger buildings than three stories. It's actually going to be for buildings six stories and under starting in the next year. We know this is technologically feasible. It's already happening in a number of municipalities across New York State where we're getting all electric newly constructed buildings. Because at this point, it's just starting to make sense to go that way, both for people's pocketbooks and for their health and to address the climate crisis. So as the budget process is underway, we're going to be strongly advocating for the All Electric Buildings Act, which is legislation carried by Senator Kavanaugh and Assemblymember Gallagher. It lines up with New York City's local law. We think it makes sense for the state to adopt what New York City has for uniformity, and again, because it's entirely doable and necessary. So that's what we'll be pushing for as budget negotiations are underway.
Well, last year, you know, Governor Hochul did put in, you know, something in the budget about this. It was pulled out. Somebody said they didn't want to do the policy in the budget, and then it did not get passed at the end of the session. Is the push going to be included in the budget, put the Oil Electric Building Act into the budget, which is legally doable, or is it going to be, you know, in the session, or is that decision not yet been made?
We are absolutely advocating for this to be done in the budget and don't see any reason to not do in the budget. So last year, the Senate included it in their One House budget, and we are strongly pushing the Assembly to do the same this year and to come to the table and negotiate on this. I think for some additional context, getting this done in the budget is really important because New York State just finalized its climate scoping plan. And addressing buildings is a big component of the scoping plan. The budget is an important document for New York State because it indicates how strong a priority something needs to be for the state. This document is going to be really important this year because it's the first coming out of this scoping plan. And it offers major opportunities for New York State to significantly tackle some of the recommendations in the scoping plan. And in many cases, it'll be important to go beyond what the scoping plan has recommended.
Now, I'm going to ask you sort of probably a little complicated question. You know, there have been a lot of pushback against the Old Electric Buildings Act. Oh, you know, heat pumps don't work in upstate New York, which I think has pretty much been discouraged. But on a different but somewhat related issue, more recently the right's been going after, oh, the people want to, you know, these climate activists want to get rid of your gas stoves and go to electric or induction type stoves. How is that gas stove issue playing out? Because that seems to be the new buzzword in the media.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, this is really not about gas stoves. It is, but it isn't. So part one to discuss this is we're really just talking about new construction here. So we're not talking about ripping people's gas stoves out of their homes. You know, there'll be a time where we are going to need to do that, but that's not what's being discussed in this legislation. This is really just about newly constructed homes. Number two, it's important to add the public health component here. 19% of childhood asthma cases can be attributed to gas stove pollution in people's homes. And there's a lot of gas stoves in New York. So tackling fossil fuels in new construction is one small way to start getting at this problem. But down the road, we are going to need to address gas stoves in a more meaningful way. It's just not actually the first thing on the docket here. We really just want to start with new buildings because we know we can't continue locking in our reliance upon fossil fuels.
Okay. So to further confuse this discussion, because we're really talking about the Old Electric Buildings Act, but mainly we have existing buildings in New York State and the Climate Council, and the governor says, you know, we have to help, you know, low and moderate income people, you know, transition to air heat pumps, which can be expensive. She's put, I believe, maybe $200 million or something on the table. I think the aggregates are talking billions, not a couple hundred million. How is that going to play out?
Yeah, the governor did put forward $200 million towards NYSERDA's Empower program to help low-income households retrofit their homes. It's good. But it's true. It's far from what is needed here. So we're hopeful that the governor and legislature will come together and include additional resources for low to moderate income households to start making their switch off of fossil fuels and to make their homes more energy efficient. Go ahead.
We just have about a minute left. Let's finish up. Where do we move forward here with the Old Electric Buildings Act? What else do you guys want to see in the budget in the last minute?
Right now, the focus is turning to the legislature. The legislature has the opportunity to negotiate in this budget process through their one-house budgets. We want to see the Assembly in particular include the All-Electric Buildings Act in their one-house budget. It's gaining tremendous popularity within the Assembly, so we see no reason for them to not have this as part of their one-house budget. And we want to make sure that all of the climate policies in the governor's, in the final budget are as strong as necessary to give New York a truly zero emissions future and to protect environmental justice communities.
If people want more information about the Oil Electric Buildings Act, Earth Justice, how best to do that?
Yeah, you can visit earthjustice.org for more information. We put out a budget release with all of our positions on what the governor's proposed, and the public can find that there.
Thank you very much, Liz Moran, New York policy advocate, Earth Justice, and this is Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk magazine.
This is Hamish Jung, and today I'm talking to Megan. Welcome, Megan. Can you give us a brief introduction of yourself?
Hey, thanks so much for having me. So my name is Megan Hetfield. I use she, her pronouns. I'm a peer recovery support specialist, and I'm also someone who identifies as no longer having a chaotic relationship with substances. And I'm also someone who loves and attends and hosts harm reduction works meetings.
Starting off with your work on Harm Reduction Works, HRW, what does harm reduction mean?
Yeah, so harm reduction is many things. It's a pragmatic strategy and evidence-based strategy for meeting people where they're at with their substance use, including alcohol. It can also be applied to things like self-harming and mental health and, disordered eating and all types of other things. But essentially, it's a way to meet people with compassion and find out what their goals are and meet them where they're at to see what they need to reach their own goals. So it's a self-determined approach as opposed to a punitive one where you're telling someone, you know, what's wrong with them and what they need to do to fix it. And, it's just a really beautiful philosophy too that centers humanity and compassion, dignity, and respect.
So specifically to drug usage, there is a stigma that comes along with it. How has this prevented quality care for users? And is there any connection in the film Love in the Time of Fentanyl that you would like to make?
Oh my gosh. You know, stigma is the biggest barrier for folks, for all types of issues, especially substance use. You know, it's the fact that it's a criminal justice issue and not a public health one in our country, and the historical roots of racist policies that continue today, you know, make it a highly stigmatized issue. You know, you can't see, but I'm wearing a shirt that says, be nice to drug users. You know, this shirt gets lots of attention because we're not taught that. We're taught, you know, people who use drugs are bad. They're morally corrupt. They're lawbreakers. You know, there must be something wrong with them. And in fact, we should be treating them, you know, the complete opposite. You know, folks who use drugs are some of the most marginalized among us. And this film, Love in the Time of Fentanyl, you know, really captures that. It captures the spirit of people treating each other like human beings, you know, despite the fact that using substances might be an aspect of their lives. It is not everything to them. It is not everything they are. It's just a part of their lives. And unfortunately, it's the part of their lives that causes so much grief, you know, due to the criminalization, due to the stigmatization, due to the criminal justice involvement that people have, and they can't seem to break free of that. And the film really, really beautifully captures what happens when you move the stigma out of the way and just treat people like human beings.
So moving on from quality care, safe injection sites allow medical supervision for people who want to inject pre-obtained drugs. How does this type of medical aid support individuals in comparison to a detox-only method?
Yes, so what you refer to as safe injection sites, which is what some people refer to them as, another name for them is overdose prevention sites, because essentially that's what they do. You know, they keep people alive with a really unstable drug supply. You know, fentanyl is a contaminant, a poison that is found in most illicit powdered or pill substances that are purchased, you know, illicitly outside of a doctor's office or pharmacy. And these centers, these overdose prevention centers, you know, center people's lives as the most important thing. You know, if you are not able to breathe and be alive, you're unable to complete something like an inpatient detox. So an inpatient detox or even an outpatient detox is a great strategy. It's a great, you know, evidence-based treatment for someone that wants to detox. But not everyone is ready for that. Right. There's many, many factors that would cause someone to not be ready to go through a detox. It can be really hard on the body, physically, mentally, emotionally. And some people don't have a safe environment to go home to after a detox. And maybe they've tried many times to detox off their substance of choice. But then when they leave, you know, they don't have the right environment to support their healing. You know, it takes many, many things for people to heal and get well, and it's different for everyone. You know, it's not a prescriptive thing. So, you know, the main difference is that the overdose prevention sites or safe injection sites in a film are a place where people can continue to be safe while they are deciding what they think is the best thing for them in regards to their drug use. And for some of them, they just don't want to stop. And they all have their own perfectly valid reasons.
90.7 FM.
Acra, Hudson, Catskill.
The police murder of Tyre Nichols and the attack on Black history. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. February 1st marked a beginning and an end. It's the first day of Black History Month, the national celebration honoring the hard-won achievements of African Americans over the painful arc of the more than 400 years since the first ship of enslaved Africans arrived in 1619. February 1st was also the day of the funeral for Tyre Nichols, the 29-year-old African-American father who died on January 10th after being brutally beaten by five Memphis police officers 3 days earlier. As Tyre was laid to rest, a firestorm was erupting over how Black history is taught, with at least one state's rejection of a proposed AP African-American history curriculum. Tyre Nichols was driving home on the evening of Saturday, January 7th, when Memphis police pulled him over, they claimed, for reckless driving. Even the police chief later admitted there was no such basis for the traffic stop.
Get the up! Damn, I didn't do anything!
Get the F out of the effing car, one officer screamed, to which Tyre responds, I didn't do anything. Police pulled Tyre from the car and roughly pinned him to the ground. Tyre appeared frightened but remained calm. As one officer tased him, he escaped, running towards home. The police caught up with Tyre on a quiet residential street just a couple hundred feet from home. More police resumed the vicious attack. Police body cameras and a pole-mounted security camera documented the assault. Tyre's final words as he was beaten into unconsciousness were to call for his mother. Less than 10 minutes after the initial traffic stop, Tyre, handcuffed and bloodied, was propped against a police car. When he fell over, he was again propped up, but otherwise ignored by the police and EMTs. 20 minutes passed before an ambulance arrived. He died in the hospital 3 days later. The five officers, all of whom are Black, were fired and charged with second-degree murder. A white officer, heard on the video saying, I hope they stomp his ass, was suspended, as was another officer. Two Memphis Fire Department EMTs were also fired, as was their on-site supervisor, a lieutenant, for failing to adequately help Tyre.
He had a beautiful soul, and he touched everyone.
That's Rovon Wells, Tyre's mother, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
The boy smiled all the time. He loved his mother's cooking. He loved his son. That's why he came to Memphis in the first place, to be with his mom, build a better life for him and his son. But Memphis took my son away from me.
Funeral, Reverend Al Sharpton delivered Tyre's eulogy, and family attorney Ben Crump spoke from the pulpit. Both men praised local racial justice and police accountability activists for bringing attention to Tyre's murder. Among those recognized was Amber Sherman, member of the Black Lives Matter Memphis chapter.
It took a lot of on-the-ground organizing, pressuring the folks in charge.
Amber Sherman said on Democracy Now!
If we hadn't had the protest on Saturday, about over a week ago, we hadn't shown up at City Hall on MLK Day, and we haven't continued to show up at the DA's office and host a sit-in, and we haven't continued to pull up on people who are not responding to us, then we definitely wouldn't be getting that video footage.
Change doesn't happen without organizing and activism, as the history of Memphis so painfully illustrates. Martin Luther King Jr. was in Memphis in 1968, supporting striking municipal sanitation workers fighting for better, safer working conditions after two workers were crushed to death in a malfunctioning garbage truck. On April 3, 1968, King gave his famous To the Mountaintop speech at Memphis's Mason Temple. The next afternoon, he was assassinated, standing on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel. While King's assassination is a well-known point in historical time, it falls on a continuum of systemic racism, white supremacy, and violence against African Americans. Tyree's killing now has a permanent place on that tragic timeline, along with the police killings of Michael Brown, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and so many more. Tyree and Breonna were both born on the same day, June 5th, 1993. Neither will reach their 30th birthday. This is why honest, comprehensive school curricula on Black history is so important. Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has championed the whitewashing of Black history, demanding the removal of topics like Black Lives Matter, police brutality, and reparations, recently leading the successful effort to ban the new AP African American history curriculum in the Sunshine State. So much for sunshine. Justice for Tyree Nichols and other Black victims of police violence ultimately relies on organized action from an informed citizenry. Black history needs not just to be a month, but taught every single day. Kids and adults need to learn the whole truth and nothing but the truth. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. On February 2nd, three local congressional representatives voted for a bill, and I quote, denouncing the horrors of socialism, end quote. House Resolution 9 is deeply ridiculous legislation. It was a show vote in a country with many socialist policies, such as the collective funding of the military for national defense. The bill passed 328-86. With Democrat Pat Ryan and Republicans Elise Stefanik voting for the resolution and Democrat Paul Tonko voting against. The resolution only said, and I quote, this concurrent resolution denounces socialism and opposes the implementation of socialist policies in the United States, end quote. This has little chance of passing the Senate nor being signed by President Joe Biden. The Cook Political Report forecast a toss-up election for Republican Mark Molinaro in the 19th Congressional District in 2024. The same group says that Pat Ryan's 18th District leans to the Democrat. Molinaro defeated Democrat Josh Riley in last fall's election, where Republicans picked up a few seats in New York. With the presidential election in 2024, turnout is likely to be higher in Molinaro and Ryan's next election. Larry Rulison reports in the Times Union that the Department of Environmental Conservation is investigating an oil spill February 2nd at the Norlite Aggregate Plant and Incinerator in Cohoes in Albany County. A DEC spill response team investigated the incident and blamed equipment failure on a waste oil tank located in the facility's equipment building for the leak of 200 gallons of waste oil onto the ground. They said there were no air quality impacts from the spill. Norlite makes aggregate from shale that is used in road and construction projects and has a history of violations with DEC in Cohoes. Norlite has been accused of emitting illegal emissions and dangerous silica dust into the air that has caused health problems for neighboring residents. Read the full story in the Times Union. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
Hey man, you got another hat in your truck? It's sunny out here. Oh no, I gave all my hats away. It seems like they were hurting my brow. Oh darn, can you run in there and get me another cup of coffee, please? Hey man, you just finished your cup of coffee. Yeah, I know, I want one more though. What are those guys talking about? I don't know, he said something about a hat. Aw. Oh.
gosh, I wish I had a hat. Yeah, why don't you run in and get me a coffee, and I'll go get you a hat at the thrift store.
Excuse me.
Oh, man, I think those guys are going to get a thrift score, they said. Oh, they're going to get all those jazz records over there. Hey, why don't you give me a coffee? Give me extra motivation to go thrifting. Oh, that guy just said he was drifting across the street there at that coffee house. I don't know what to do. Hey, I think that guy said he's drifting. We might have to get out the boats. Oh, I don't know. Hey, I think that guy across the street at the coffee house says he's drifting. Drifting? He looks more like he's grifting. Ha ha, good one. Hey, those two guys across the street at the coffee house said that they're grifting or sifting. I couldn't make it out. Aw, dude, have another coffee. Hey, this is cool. They got brown napkins, so if you spill your coffee, nobody knows. Ha ha ha, good one. Hey, can you get a little more vanilla in my coffee? Yeah, I did get vanilla in your coffee, but they only had raspberry amaretto. No, I don't like that stuff. Hey, man, that guy just said he's into amaretto like my little sister. Ha ha ha, yeah, that's a good one. Is your little sister like coffee? Nah, she's only 4. She has to have half a cup. Hey, I think those two guys across the street just made fun of your little sister. Oh, man, after I have all this coffee, I'm gonna go mess them up. Oh, those guys had so much coffee over there. I think they're all messed up, if you know what I mean, in the pants area.
Battlefield Earth, every Tuesday night from 9:30 to midnight.
Tune in to All Together Now, WGXC's collaborative hour-long news show at 6 p.m., featuring local and regional news, weather updates, and newsmaker interviews. Tune in to learn more about the issues that affect communities throughout the Capital Region and the Hudson Valley, from the Catskills to the Berkshires.
WGXC believes in hands-on, two-way radio. We provide public access to the airwaves, giving individuals and organizations the means to tell their own stories. WGXC listeners make radio, participate in on-air conversations, record public meetings for broadcast, contribute content, host their own shows, and more. The G and the C stand for Greene and Columbia Counties in New York. WGXC is listener-supported, and we serve 78,000 potential local listeners in the Upper Hudson Valley, in addition to listeners from across the globe online. Our programs can be surprising, while wholesome, are very often experimental, and almost always entertaining. Program applications are accepted year-round, and no prior radio experience is required.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Spike's Record Rack in Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1908. That was the day the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on the Lowe versus Lawler case, also known as the Danbury Hatters case. In 1902, the United Hatters of North America attempted to organize the fur hat company, D.E. Lowe & Company. Lowe refused to meet with the union. The union struck and called for a nationwide boycott of Lowe hats. The AFL assisted in popularizing the boycott. They worked to convince retailers and customers not to buy from Lowe. The company sued the union's business agent and hundreds of its members. Lowe claimed the union violated the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890 by interfering with interstate commerce. The Sherman Act had been designed to control big business monopolies, trusts, and cartels like the Standard Oil Company. An 1893 case, United States versus Workingmen's Amalgamated Council of New Orleans, established that the Sherman Act applied to labor unions as well. In the Danbury Hatters case, the Supreme Court ruled that the union combined to restrain trade or commerce among several states. The union countered by arguing that the union did not interfere with the transportation of hats and were not themselves engaged in interstate commerce. But the union lost. In addition to violating the Sherman Act, the court argued that individual union members could be held personally liable for damages incurred by their unions. The union was eventually held liable in damages amounting to $235,000. The AFL pushed back, demanding reforms in the Sherman Act. Partial reforms came with the Clayton Antitrust Act of 1914, but it would be another 20 years before the Norris-LaGuardia Act would exempt organized labor from antitrust injunctions.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When extreme rain hits, water utility workers need to respond quickly to keep communities safe from flooding, sewer overflows, and other hazards.
These folks are in the trenches, literally dealing with extreme events.
Katerina Gonzalez is a researcher at the University of Minnesota Climate Adaptation Partnership. She's helping Seattle Public Utilities find ways to engage their frontline workers in preparing for more extreme weather.
Oftentimes, planning for adaptation is siloed in like planning departments or policy departments, and they don't value the lived experience of the frontline workers.
But she says these workers have a wealth of on-the-ground knowledge, and they can provide utilities with valuable feedback on how plans are working, if new strategies or equipment are needed, or how to better allocate resources. She says as climate change brings more heavy rain, these employees are shouldering a growing workload.
We're seeing more overtime hours during these extreme events, more staff on standby, more concern about safety.
So she says it's important to include workers in climate adaptation planning. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Back the tears. think I'm gonna miss you a long, long time. 'Cause I've done everything I know to try and make you mine. I think I'm gonna love you for a long, long
time. Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Gondary, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Hope Hickerson, and I'm a health education specialist and reporter. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health education expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know to keep yourself and your loved ones healthy.
For more information about Noise Filter, your public health podcast, and to watch and share our incredible informative animations, please visit us at noisefiltershow.com.
And if you like what you hear, don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to us. So, let's get started.
Study finds alcohol and tobacco use shared among diverse ancestries. Alcohol and tobacco use can cause approximately 5 to 15% deaths worldwide, respectively, and are associated with chronic illnesses such as cancer. Several physical and mental illnesses are associated with smoking and drinking, including cardiovascular disease and psychiatric disorders. Environmental and social factors influence both tobacco consumption and alcohol consumption, but genetics can also play a role.
So a study involving nearly 3.4 million people with African, American, East Asian, and European ancestry identified more than 3,500 genetic variations that likely affect smoking and drinking behavior. Using data collected from samples from different ancestries, researchers discovered that the genes related to alcohol and tobacco use behaviors were strikingly similar in samples from different ancestries, with 80% of the variants having a consistent effect across all populations studied.
In part, the similarity across ancestries may be due to the fact that the vast majority of non-European groups included in the study live in the U.S., where they're likely to experience similar environmental influences such as public health policies and alcohol and tobacco availability. Middle Eastern and Indian populations where smoking is often prevalent were not included in the analysis. The analysis would be more accurate and would be able to identify more genetic associations if these populations were included.
As a result, the researchers acknowledge that their sample does not represent the full diversity of genetic ancestry and geography across the globe. They stated that in future phases of the study, they will welcome collaborations from other investigators who have access to additional data sets to further expand their studies.
That being said, it's incredibly interesting to look at genetic factors that may lead to an overdependence on alcohol and tobacco, and to find that in a huge study of over 3 million people, the genetic factors largely tracked between populations. So often, especially with items that are considered to be vices, those who don't face a challenge with these substances cannot understand why others do so. Can't they just face their free will to stop their bad habits? But we never know which of the 3,500 genetic factors each individual might have. So let's take this as a reminder to practice some empathy and perhaps, instead of judging, try to help. So, interesting considerations here. Of course, we know that genetics and can predict addiction and addiction to alcohol and tobacco are some of the most common addictions in our society. Oftentimes, we think about addiction, we think about addiction to maybe heavy drugs or opioids, but alcohol use disorder and tobacco use disorder are more common and quote unquote more quote unquote socially acceptable, I suppose. So, And we have seen that, I will say this. Let's take a peek behind the curtain and look at what the drinking culture is like here in New Orleans compared to the rest of the country. Right? Right? Oftentimes, when we go somewhere else and we'll have a drink or two, it's just different. I don't know. Have you found it? Have you noticed the difference between, when you go back up north or what have you, that the drinking culture in southern Louisiana versus the rest of the country?
Yes. Well, I mean, when I first moved here from North Carolina, we had ABC stores, and the ABC stores, where you could buy alcohol, and it was closed on Sundays.
All right, those are the government state alcohol stores.
Yes, that's right. The only place we could buy alcohol. And then when I first moved here, and there was alcohol in the grocery store, I just about passed out. They sell alcohol, and then I walked in like CVS or Walgreens, and there was alcohol. I could not believe it.
Right.
Where am I? It was so foreign to me. And so, yeah, there's a huge difference. So it's there's more of a morality thing, right? Then, up north, where it's like, oh, we don't sell us Sundays. What is that? It's a day. But, there's a huge difference. Here, it's just expected, okay, we're going to drink, we're going to have a drink, and it's fine. It's no big deal. Up there, in certain places, it's like, well, let me kind of sneak in by this. It's a little bit different. Yeah.
Right. My wife and I went to Scotland over the holidays, and we love it there, and just we love the people and the culture. And we love how the Scottish government saves, we joke that they save the Scots from themselves by having some very specific laws in place. One is you cannot buy alcohol after 10 p.m. anywhere, period, end of discussion. For private consumption, and two, all the bars close at midnight, full stop, everything is closed, no alcohol. In fact, a lot of bars do it beforehand. So it was weird for us as we were there, holidays, and we were looking to be out and about, and then come 11, lights start flickering, 11:30, doors are opening, and they're like, time to go, so that they don't. It's weird because here in New Orleans, there are bars that have no locks on the doors.
Right.
So they're always open. And so we often joke that it's just the Scots saving them from themselves. So there's a love of alcohol. Alcohol fuels their social circuits as well. So it was just, uh, it was, it was a, it